Hi, I'm Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange. Now, here in The Exchange, as you know, we're not afraid of complicated issues or strong opinions or debates. In fact, we jump into these conversations because we know they help you learn. And we know that you're open to hearing something that might challenge your own beliefs. But guess what? These conversations happen here thanks to the financial support of listeners like you. So contribute now to support radio that doesn't shy away from the hard stuff, the difficult topics. It's easy to do at nhpr.org or follow the link right there in the show notes. And thank you.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The politics of football continued this week with the White House holding a celebration of America yesterday instead of the planned Super Bowl ceremony honoring the champion Philadelphia Eagles. The announcement was made after it became clear few team members would attend, and it comes shortly after the National Football League released its new policy on conduct during the national anthem. The NFL says team members must stand while the anthem is played if they're on the field or choose to stay in the locker room. It also says the league can fine teams whose players do otherwise. Today in The Exchange, what's going on in football? We'll talk about that first, then later in the hour, water contamination and a recent EPA visit to New Hampshire that could have national implications. Join us. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We have two guests. Michael McCann is in studio, legal analyst for Sports Illustrated, director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at UNH School of Law. And Michael, it's great to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for having me on.
Also joining us by phone, Howard Bryant, author of The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. He's also a senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, and an NPR correspondent. And Howard, really good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
No, thank you for having me, Laura.
Well, Howard, you first. Your reaction to the president's announcement about the Philadelphia Eagles visit being canceled, saying we're going to celebrate America instead, and to heck with you, the Eagles. What do you think?
Well, I think that this was a continuation of the culture war that he started going after the players back in September. And I think that he's been completely consistent with what he's been doing to football players, and that is he's going to use them as a political tool to keep his base fired up. And I think that it's something that is not a surprise at all. I think the trouble part comes from the players in the league, which had been trying to work out some compromise, and they did work out a $90 million negotiation to partner on social justice issues that was supposed to put this whole thing to rest. And then obviously the players felt a little backstabbed when the owners came up with this national anthem policy, which they felt was unnecessary. And then, of course, Trump ratcheted up the culture war again with his announcement with the Philadelphia Eagles thing yesterday. So to me, I think what's really taken place is, from a football standpoint, the last thing, it reminds me a lot of steroids, the last thing that the owners want is to start another season talking about something other than football, and they're about to get into another season where protest becomes the issue instead of the game on the field.
What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I think Howard's right, that this has become a political issue that the owners don't want to address, that this is a distraction from the game. And the president's comments criticizing players for protesting and criticizing owners in the league for not taking punitive steps against that conduct, it doesn't actually deter players from doing it. If it does anything, it encourages more players to join in the protest. So clearly this is designed as a political tool to get more support for a position that I think many Americans probably agree with the president on, and the president is likely mindful of that. And he's taking advantage of it.
Well, and as Howard mentioned, this has been going on for a while. And speaking of the mixing of football and politics, here's the president at a rally for Alabama U.S. Senate Republican nominee Luther Strange last fall, invoking his view of what's patriotic and what isn't, and referencing those NFL players who kneel during the national anthem. Let's hear.
Luther and I, and everyone in this arena tonight, are unified by the same great American values. We're proud of our country. We respect our flag. Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of off the field right now, out. He's fired. He's fired.
So that's President Trump again talking about the politics of football, what he would like to see the NFL owners do. And Howard, how do you think the NFL owners have handled this situation, these strong feelings that their players have about needing to make a statement for racial justice?
No, I think they've handled it very poorly. I think they've caught themselves in a situation where they've mangled the situation, to be honest, because you can't negotiate with someone like this president, because to him, a negotiation is based on wins and losses. There's no compromise in the middle. So, of course, the owners felt like they compromised with the players with this national anthem policy in terms of, well, okay, if you don't want to stand, then you can hang out in the locker room. And then he came back and said, well, even being in the locker room is disrespectful. So as it turns out, there is no compromise. And I think one of the things about this book that I really wanted to focus on, for all the conversations about the divisions that we have, and we have plenty, I think the one thing that I really enjoyed was listening to veterans themselves talk about not wanting to be used as props, not wanting the American flag to be used as a prop, not wanting the commercialism in the game to sort of infect the spirit of why they joined or what oath they took to defend the country. And that's all of those things have actually happened in the opposite. It's become a real spectacle. And on the one hand, when Michael was saying that this is something that a lot of Americans agree with, it's really interesting what agreement we're talking about, because in my research in this project, I found that a lot of people felt, and especially veterans, really felt like the commercialism, the selling, the packaging of the flag, the paid patriotism from John McCain and Jeff Flake underneath all of this has run this game so far away from sort of what they had envisioned that nobody's comfortable.
Well, and to Howard's point, Michael, that the NFL owners have mangled this, as Howard said, you can see them kind of struggling because football is a bipartisan issue. I mean, it's kind of, with all due respect to baseball, it's kind of become America's sport.
Yeah, and the anthem issue, of course, is something that the league brought upon itself. Prior to 2009, the anthem was played before games while players were in the locker room. The league pivoted that year to play it before the game while players were on the field.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, so give us a little more of that. That's interesting.
So this was a change in game operations, and the league periodically makes changes in game operations. It wasn't done with great fanfare. It wasn't done with much notice. It was done around the same time the league entered into a contractual relationship with the National Guard for a sponsorship, that it was seen as a way of just creating a greater sense of patriotism that involves the players. And again, it wasn't controversial. It only became controversial 7 years later when Colin Kaepernick kneeled. And that, of course, as we know, sparked off this debate, a debate that had largely abated by the start of last season. And then, of course, you played the president's comments during the political rally, which triggered it all over again. And it sort of expanded it. So, you know, there's a history to this that's in part intentional and in part not intentional.
Well,
yeah, and actually, Laura, that's exactly what this book is about. I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about this, to Michael's point, is you've got a collision here, and the unspoken part of this collision is not Donald Trump. That gets a lot of fanfare. That's the third part of it. But the real unspoken part of this collision is the post 9/11 packaging and selling of sports, colliding with this revived post-Ferguson black athlete. 9/11 has changed all of how we market, how we sell, how we view sports. And Michael's 100% right. It was completely uncontroversial because at that time, nobody wanted to stand up against it. But at the same time, there were many, many people who were watching this game going back to 9/11, going back to the two wars that were fought during this, and looking at the growth of camouflage uniforms, camouflage jerseys, flags, flyovers, and surprise homecomings, and all of these things that were taking place, not knowing that they were all being funded by the DOD, that they were being funded by local National Guards. For example, the Wisconsin National Guard paid the Milwaukee Brewers $49,000 to sing God Bless America during the seventh inning of games. And so this whole thing was happening. And then, of course, when Ferguson occurs, now, or actually when Trayvon Martin is killed earlier, but by the time of Ferguson, now you've got these athletes who are pushing back because suddenly the sports field itself is now a display of not just flags and flyovers, but also this conflation of police and first responders being conflated with the military. And so when you had that domestic issue happening in cities colliding with this international sort of war on terror, it took place on the sports field.
Really interesting. So you're writing about Howard in your book, again, The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism, a politicization and a militarization of sport.
Well, absolutely. And that's where I was saying earlier about how the when you talk to veterans about this, they view this as crass commercialism, a lot of them, in terms of when you and Michael is, you know, he's got this right, because we're talking the thing about it that gets me is the lack of controversy to it. I asked several people during the interviews for this project, and especially the John McCain, Jeff Flake, and when you said this was bipartisan, that was not bipartisan. That was a Republican initiative from two Arizona senators. And obviously John McCain's military service needs no introduction. And yet when you talk to people about the fact that this patriotism is actually commercialism on the field, that it's all really a deception, so many times the response that the Flake McCain people got, the response that I got, that a lot of people get, was, well, okay, it's a deception, but it's a harmless deception, because who's not against terrorism and who's not for the troops, and so this is fine. It's a harmless deception. It's a very interesting way to put it. And so this is what our sports fields look like. And underneath it is money. It's really not a question of patriotism. It's a question of commercialism.
Well, I want to play another clip. This is from Malcolm Jenkins of the Philadelphia Eagles. He produced a video giving his views as a player on this whole controversy and the issues that you talk about, Howard. And Jenkins says players hope to use this moment to bring people together, not to divide Americans, but to bring people together to have tough conversations about race in America. Let's hear a little bit from Malcolm Jenkins.
And if it's one thing that I've learned from being on a team, that with players that are from different races, different backgrounds, different religions, is that when we listen to each other and we respect one another, we can always work together toward a common goal to winning. And that's what we want to do as Americans, is win. And the first part I challenge you to do is to really listen and give others an opportunity to speak.
Again, that's Malcolm Jenkins of the Philadelphia Eagles. Today in The Exchange, the politics of football, from the NFL's new policy on taking a knee during the national anthem to the cancellation this week of a ceremony at the White House to honor the Super Bowl champion team, the Philadelphia Eagles. Let's get your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Howard and Michael, let's go to our listeners. Mark is calling in from Concord. Hi, Mark. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Laura. I've enjoyed your shows over the years. I am an attorney, a real estate titling attorney, and in the recesses of my mind, I remember some constitutional law where there were cases where, for instance, Moose Club v. Pennsylvania, where discrimination, a Moose Club was sued because of liquor laws, and that was the public connection. My question is, why can't the Players Association sue on First Amendment grounds against the municipalities that have put up taxpayer money for various stadiums. There are any number of NFL teams that are playing in publicly financed stadiums and the tenants in the place. And so you would think that the Players Association could sue the municipalities to enjoin their tenants from prohibiting players to express their First Amendment rights.
Well, Mark, this is really interesting. Yeah, and Michael, I'm going to turn to you first. So we've gotten a lot of questions, actually, about is this a First Amendment issue or not?
Yeah, no, Mark makes a really good point that there are ways of envisioning the First Amendment so that it could apply. I think the conventional response is that it's probably not a First Amendment issue, that this is fundamentally a matter between a private employer and a contractual employee who's also in a union, that this invokes labor law, contract law, potentially antitrust law, more so than it would the First Amendment. But as Mark noted, there have been some who believe that the nexus between public funding of stadiums and the players playing in those stadiums creates a sufficient bond that could trigger First Amendment protection. I think the short answer is we don't know if that would prevail. It certainly is not an argument that we've seen play out by any player or the union itself. Right now, the players are focused on using the collective bargaining agreement, using specifically provisions about collusion, which is what Colin Kaepernick has argued, that he has been colluded against by at least two teams or the league in one team.
Because nobody's hiring him.
Because nobody's hiring him. So that at this point, it's a labor question more than anything else. That doesn't preclude other areas of law from entering the story. But it is worth stressing that judges are often reluctant to start turning to other areas of law when there are collectively bargained provisions, because usually those provisions are considered to have preempted other claims until they've been played out. So this could have a long legal story. Right now, the focus is on labor law.
So, go ahead, Howard. Yeah, sure.
I was going to say that Michael's on to as well, which is, one, the Players Association has only viewed this through the lens of collective bargaining. In fact, one of the things that took place when Colin Kaepernick first took a knee back in 2016 was, okay, let's put together our response. And the response was, of course, as Michael knows from a legal standpoint, was precedent. And the precedent was when the St. Louis Rams came out of the tunnel after Ferguson with the hands up, don't shoot gesture. Immediately, the St. Louis police unions wanted the players to be sanctioned, and because Roger Goodell did not sanction them, that was their precedent not to sanction anything against Colin Kaepernick. And the rationale was that what was taking place took place before the game actually started. So they were all working. All the strategies have been used within the framework of collective bargaining. And that's exactly sort of how they've looked at it. And then also because the Players Association has often been very reluctant as well to not really get too deeply involved in this. They're being sucked into something that they really don't want any part of. They've been reluctant because the Players Association feels that their job is to protect jobs, grow jobs, and negotiate contracts. They're being pulled into something, into a social element, because of the players that they're not even sure that they want to be in. So it'll be interesting to see how they, you know, what other tactics and strategies that they employ, or if they just want this to go away as well.
Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, Howard brings up a good point. Sort of, if you're the union, what do you want to expend energy on? What do you want to spend bargaining leverage on? Should it be on something like this, whether players have to stand for the anthem, which is important, certainly symbolically important, but you could argue there are more important issues, such as how much money do players get? What about their pension? What about their long-term disability? What about concussion litigation? I mean, there are all sorts of issues that are far more impactful on their lives than this.
All right. Well, lots more to talk about after a break, and we'll keep taking your calls. Mark, thank you for that one. I also have a couple emails I want to share with both of you. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. More on the politics of football on The Exchange in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, football and politics. The Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles decided to stay away from a White House celebration yesterday, making waves and coming shortly after the NFL's new policy on conduct during the national anthem. We're talking about what cultural, political, legal issues this raises, also how the public's reacting. So let's definitely hear from you. What do you make of all this? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Howard Bryant joins us by phone. He's author of The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and the Politics of Patriotism. Howard's also a senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, and an NPR correspondent. Michael McCann's with me in studio, legal analyst for Sports Illustrated, director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at UNH School of Law. And gentlemen, while we're talking about how the players feel about this, whether the players' union would rather get back to something else, how the NFL owners, as Howard said, have mangled this issue, to use Howard's words, let's hear a little bit from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. This is him announcing the recent ban on taking a knee or sitting, if you're on the field, during the national anthem.
We want people to be respectful at the national anthem. We want people to stand. That's all personnel, and make sure that they treat this moment in a respectful fashion. That's something that we think we owe.
Okay, so again, that's NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. And Howard, you talked about this earlier, but just to reiterate, you have observed this growth of sports, especially maybe the NFL, sort of conflating sport, patriotism, the military. So just remind us of that again.
Well, I think that the conflation started obviously in 9/11. I was covering the New York Yankees in 2001 on that day, on that Tuesday morning. And so we remember that very well. You remember when all of those firemen and Port Authority and police officers went into those towers. And the way that sports has dealt with that ever since changed. It's not just change in sports. I make the argument in the book that 9/11 is the defining moment for people's lives. When I was a kid, it was the Russians. It was the Cold War. That's what we feared. And today, if you were born in, say, in 1990, you, 9/11, you were 10 years old or 11 years old. And that has been exactly what you've seen. That's what you've, that's the lens through which you've seen sports being marketed. That's the way you watch sports. And so that conflation, sports are now, or I'm sorry, let me put it this way, that the military and the police are part of the game day experience for you. This is your normal. This, my son was born in 2004. This is his normal. So for his generation, this is what they know. And so then when you have police brutality, all the videos and things that are also viral on YouTube and everything else, and you see those videos and the players getting involved, whether it's Carmelo Anthony in basketball or Colin Kaepernick in football, Eric Reed and Malcolm Jenkins, you have this collision on the field. And so when the response has been stick to sports, you see that collision. You see where that conflict arises. And so it's been very, very difficult for, I think, the leagues to understand or figure out how to deal with this, because they hadn't had to deal with an active black athlete since the Muhammad Ali, Jackie Robinson, Bill Russell days. So it's really, really difficult to see how they play. And for the public, does not know a period where this was normal for them.
Well, and speaking again of how the NFL has handled this, how the public feels about it, we've got a lot of messages from our public. Jerry sent us an email from Dover. He says this is a classic example of an organization shooting themselves in the foot and then compounding the situation by shooting themselves in the other foot. I cannot conceive, Jerry says, of the NFL handling this any worse. So that's Jerry in Dover. And then we have Ken, who emailed, who says, I am an active serving member of the military. Ken says, I support the protests because I believe in free speech and for us as a country to confront social justice for all. Ken says, I hate that the flag and the veterans who have defended it are disrespected, but that we cannot tolerate lives being lost on our soil. The purpose of our flag is so that all have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And Ken, thank you for that email. Here's another one from Carrie. Society shakes its head when young black men riot to express their frustrations. However, when the few young black men with some power model a peaceful form of protest, we shoot them down as unpatriotic. The USA is about protesting inequality. There's nothing more American than rebellion. It's how we came to be in the first place. Kerry says taking a knee is still a respectful posture. If they were sitting around cleaning their fingernails, that would be an issue. So, Kerry, thank you again for those emails. And again, you can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. And guys, let's go to the phones. And Tim is in Durham. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. This is Tim Horrigan. I'm a state rep from Durham. And we've seen even the militarization of the national anthem in a small way at the New Hampshire House. We now expect those members, your veterans, to instead of just holding a hand over the heart and just standing for the Pledge of Allegiance national anthem to salute, so we know like which ones they are, which I guess is harmless enough. But there's, this whole thing with the national anthem, it started long before Trump, and it's, I'll keep talking here. I think I got cut off. But the
Tim, you're still there. Go ahead. You can wrap up your point.
Okay. I heard my phone was beeping. It started long before Trump. This is like a lot of different social trends coming together. But I think what Trump did yesterday is just not normal. That's not what a president should do.
Although Tim, thank you for calling in. And I think your phone is, we're sort of losing you a little bit there. But I think I read, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, that other teams have not gone to the White House for these ceremonies, right? This isn't unprecedented, this sudden lack of a ceremony.
That's right. The lack of a ceremony itself is not unprecedented. What is unprecedented is the invitation being extended, accepted, and then rescinded. So that part of the story is unprecedented. So last year, the Golden State Warriors did not go to the White House after winning the NBA championship. And there's some debate as to whether the president ever extended it. This is a team that has spoken out against President Trump, and President Trump has spoken out either indirectly or in some cases directly about NBA players who oppose him. So in that regard, it's true that not every championship team has gone to the White House, and the practice didn't start in the 18th century also. It started in 1924, I believe, was when it began. So this isn't some trusted thing that has gone on forever.
Like the State of the Union.
Right.
It must happen.
Right. It doesn't have to happen.
But presidents like the photo op, right? Of,
sure.
You know, being with the champions. And
it's an easy story, right? It's a great way of just celebrating champions, people that, individuals that people respect and admire. It's an easy political win for a White House of either party. And yet, of course, we know that that hasn't happened in this context.
I have to ask you this real quick, Michael. I couldn't help but think that if the Patriots had won the Super Bowl instead of the Philadelphia Eagles, sorry, Patriots fans, I know it's a painful memory, would we have seen this cancellation given the political proclivities of the Patriots ownership and Tom Brady?
We don't know, but I think we can
be. I'm asking you to play what if. I know that's not really fair. But
so the what if, I would suspect that the celebration would have happened. We know that President Trump and Robert Kraft our friends, although Robert Kraft has criticized President Trump on this specific issue. So there has been a give and take there. But yeah, it seems as if their relationship is good. We know that Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, the extent of their friendship or support of the president isn't clear, but we know that they're at least sympathetic. So I would imagine that the ceremony would have occurred.
Okay, let's take another call. And Tim, thank you for that one. Jim's calling from Boscawen. Hi, Jim. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, it seems that their relationship is good. We know that Bill Belichick.
Hello.
From Brady.
Hi, Jim. You're supposed to turn your radio down when you call in. Can you turn your radio down and then make your point, please?
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead.
All right. I'm calling as a fan that saw our colleague Kaepernick do the what we looked at the time that it happened is disrespecting the flag and America. I really think the players picked a bad venue to try and bring out this protest against racial injustice, because people that were watching the game with me, we all felt the same way. What is this guy doing? Why is he doing that? And there was no previous message to let us know why he was doing it. I think he disenfranchised most of the fans by the time that he picked to do it and without any previous notice of it. So right off the bat, it was a losing proposition to them. And ever since then, the dialogue hasn't changed. Yeah, we heard that it's about racial injustice, but we still look at it as disrespecting the flag. And uh, I just
I'm curious about what I'm curious about. They didn't do this until Trump became president. And right now, blacks are doing better under Trump as president than they ever did under Obama. But these protests never happened then.
Well, Jim,
I'm not sure I understand what they're really trying to get at.
Well, two points that I'd love to follow up on with our guest, Jim. So thank you for the call. The second one first, Howard, if I could. Jim's right. There were issues of police brutality, you know, young black men unarmed being shot and killed by police under President Obama. So why now?
Well, because Jim's wrong. That's why. Because Jim, the Trayvon, I talk to my son about this all the time when we talk about police brutality and we talk about these issues. And the first thing I say to him was, when Trayvon Martin was killed, even though he wasn't killed by a police officer, who was president? And he says, President Obama. And then there was protest under President Obama because the Miami Heat all donned hoodies and were on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Donald Trump wasn't president. Obama was president, so they protested under him as well. When Colin Kaepernick took a knee on September 1st, 2016, Donald Trump wasn't president. Barack Obama was president. So they were protesting under Obama as well. When Michael Brown was killed in 2014 and Eric Garner was killed in 2014 and Tamir Rice was killed in 2014, Barack Obama was president, and yet the players came out and protested. So let's not get our facts wrong on this.
So there were sports leaders protesting.
Protests during Barack Obama's presidency on this. That's when it started. Secondarily, if you are confused about why the players, and the one area where I will agree with your caller on this is that I think that the players had to recognize that challenging the flag, that even the perception of challenging the flag was going to be a very, very difficult thing to sustain. It was going to get everybody's attention, but it was going to be very difficult to sustain, and I thought they needed to change their tactics and move their tactics around and do different things along with taking a knee if that's what they felt was the important gesture. And it was the important gesture because people were talking about it, but there had to be more than that. But the other piece of this, too, that I think is most important is our job as media. And I think that the reason why people don't understand what's taking place is because we have decided as a media that we are not going to cover the reason why people are taking a knee. We're going to cover the reaction to the flag, and we're going to pander to the public that cares more about the flag than the reason why these players are protesting. We don't cover Tamir Rice's mother who lost her son. We don't cover the stories about about Daniel Shaver, the white man who was killed by police in Arizona. We're not covering the actual reason why these players are protesting. Instead, we're covering the reaction to the flag far more and far more completely. We're pandering to the reaction and not to the cause of why these players are doing this. And I think that's one of the big media fails.
So that's why, people don't understand.
And I think the other piece of this that's really important, too, to the point earlier, is that I think we've also, one of the most difficult things about this result of paid patriotism that we've seen in sports is that we are increasingly accepting the idea that the American flag represents soldiers and represents the military and not the other way around. So I think we have our images jumbled, and I think we have, in a lot of ways, we have our ideals jumbled. And I think that's the part of a functioning media where we're really not doing our jobs. And I think that that's sort of where a lot of this misdirection takes place.
So callers like Jim say, hey, where does this come from? And you're saying, Howard, that's because the media has not done a good job covering the depth of stories behind these protests. It's a lot easier to just say, hey, the president did this. Hey, Roger Goodell said that. You know, that's the easy story.
They're protesting the flag. And if you and it's very convenient in a lot of ways, because I think that's what people I think that's what people in our business relate to. I think that the hard part for all of us is when you look at sports and the structure of sports, whether you like it or whether you don't, is white owners, white coaches, white season ticket buyers, white media, black player. And so the lens of the black player, or the black player, is always viewed through that lens. And so the comfortable lens is the flag. That's what the majority understands. And I think it's very difficult, and I've talked to Colin Kaepernick about this, and I talked to Eric Reid, and I talked to Malcolm Jenkins about this, about tactics. How then do you want to get your message across with tactics that the public, that might resonate with the public? It's a really, really interesting. It's a strategic issue. And the players, I don't think they did a great job on this, because you can't beat the American flag. You have to figure out a way to use these tactics to get your point across.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, and I think building on what Howard just said, players are protesting or kneeling, however way you want to put it, for different reasons, right? That now some players appear to be doing it, at least in part, out of solidarity with other players, which is a different reason from Colin Kaepernick's original impetus to do it. Similarly, some players, I think, are doing it out of political opposition to the president, that they don't like the president telling them, you have to stop doing this. That there's this is now becoming political speech.
Too, Michael, remember that when Jerry Jones and the players for that those 2 weeks after that Alabama speech, all of a sudden you had owners taking a knee, and of course they weren't doing it for police brutality. They were doing it because they were mad that the president criticized their business.
That's right. They didn't want a division between the players and managers and so forth. Did you want to finish up there, Michael? So last question for both of you guys, and I can't believe we've run out of time. Howard, last question for you. This coming football season, how many, talking about solidarity in the team, how many white players do you expect to stay in the locker room with their black colleagues just deciding, you know, I'm not going to get involved in this. I'm going to stay with you in the locker room.
Virtually none. The women have been so much better at this than the men. When you look at solidarity in team sports, the WNBA has been great on this. They've been much more a team. I think when you look at the history of this heritage of black athletes being involved in political issues, white players have never joined them, whether it was during the Jackie Robinson days, no matter whether Pee Wee Reese put his arm around Jackie Robinson, in, as legend has it, or whether he didn't, as scholars say it never happened, or whether you go into the 60s or the 70s. This has been an issue for black athletes in the black community, and the white players have never ridden along. So it's nice to see a player like Chris Long get involved, but I wouldn't expect there to be any sort of rising tide. What I would say, and Michael can take over for the rest of this, is this is a labor issue if you're a player. To me, if you're the Players Association, you view this as a labor issue. You view this because a bunch of your owners decided to blackball one of your own as players. And if you don't view it as a labor issue, I don't think it's going to gain any traction anywhere else.
Michael, last question for you real quick. You've written that one thing is certain. If the NFL believes its new anthem policy will end the anthem controversy, they couldn't be more mistaken.
Yeah, because this, and as Howard alluded to, this is a workplace conduct issue. This is about a contractual employee who's part of a union, and whether or not there's been a change in employment that affects hours, wages, and working conditions. That this is not, you know, the big free speech that we're sort of political question. It's really about labor law and potentially antitrust law and potentially civil rights. And until that story plays out, it will continue to be a controversy.
All right, we'll come back this fall, guys, because there'll probably be more to talk about here. Thank you both so much. Howard, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
No, thank you.
Howard Bryant, author of The Heritage, Black Athletes, A Divided America, and The Politics of Patriotism. Michael McCann, really good to have you too. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Michael McCann, legal analyst for Sports Illustrated, director of the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at UNH School of Law. Coming up, we'll turn to water contamination here in the Granite State and a recent EPA visit. Stay with us.
You listen to NHPR day in and day out, month after month.
Morning edition on NHPR. Happy New Year.
As a sustaining member, your support is also ongoing and monthly.
This is All Things Considered. 4th of July celebrations are happening across the
country. And because of sustaining members, we're able to put more funding into the programs you love and invest in future reporting.
Happy Labor Day. Midterm elections are just 2 months away.
Join the thousands of NHPR listeners who contribute monthly. Go to nhpr.org and click on Donate.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, bug-borne illnesses. We're talking ticks and mosquitoes. Send us your questions about this before the show to exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Right now, NHPR environment reporter Annie Ropeek is with us for an update on water contamination. Given that EPA was here this week looking at this, on the Seacoast in particular, but the visit raises much larger issues for other parts of the state and really the whole country. That's because the agency is looking at standards for a huge class of chemicals called PFAS. Right now, there is no binding limit on the allowable amount at the federal level, but that could change, and New Hampshire could play a role in this. So let's get your questions in now. It's complicated, but important for the state. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Annie, you're always helping us out. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And just in the interest of full disclosure, as we begin this conversation, my husband works at EPA, so I just want to put that out there. Annie, why were top EPA officials in New Hampshire this week, and where were they in particular?
Yeah, so we had some really senior officials in Greenland. We had the head of the National Superfund Task Force, Stephen Cook. We had the head of the National Site Cleanup Office and the head of New England EPA. And they were meeting with people who live near the Coakley Landfill Superfund site. So it's actually in Northampton. It's right on the town line with Greenland. And it was a municipal landfill that used to serve Portsmouth and the surrounding area that is now a Superfund site, which is a federal toxic waste cleanup site. So federally managed. And it's been that way for decades. So people who live near the site are worried that contamination might be spreading from the site into their drinking water. They've been really hounding EPA about this, and finally they got a promise from EPA a couple months ago that they would come visit them and hear them out, and this week they came and did that.
So what have they found and not found about Coakley's impact on their water?
Yeah, so they have found high levels of certain contaminants. These are these PFAS chemicals that you mentioned at the site itself. So inside the landfill and in nearby Berry's Brook, which is a little stream that runs next to the landfill. So there is contamination within the landfill, and it may be moving off site. They don't fully understand which direction it's moving or how much of it is moving yet. And importantly, they have not found high levels of contamination in anyone's drinking water.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah, they tested people's tap water in that area.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can get into arguments about the high levels and like what levels are being found in people's drinking water. I mean, you know, if you're talking like a couple parts per trillion, that doesn't meet the standard for action, but it might worry a homeowner. And you know, they're these are chemicals, and we'll talk about this, but they're everywhere. And so finding a tiny, tiny bit of them is not a huge surprise, no matter where you are. Finding a lot of them might, you know, indicate something worse is going on. And so that's what they're worried may end up happening at Coakley if contamination is allowed to continue, you know, moving around at the site.
So even though nothing really big and scary yet,
no threat to human health. Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit from New England EPA Administrator Alexandra Dunn. As you said, she met with neighbors at the Coakley landfill site in Greenland. And she says, look, we're looking forward to working with you, addressing your concerns.
I know that there's been a lot of frustration around this issue, but it felt today like we have a chance to really move forward very, very thoughtfully, collaboratively, and we're looking forward to being a part of it.
So being a part of it. So what is it, Annie?
That's the million-dollar question. So there was a lot of, you know, this optimism and sort of, you know, handshaking at this meeting on Monday, but no concrete details about what steps EPA might take. Right now, they say that the remedy at the site, the sort of plan they have in place to manage it, is protective of human health, which is the goal. They say they're constantly reevaluating that and making sure that's still true. And the thing about Coakley and about these PFAS chemicals is that Coakley is an old superfund. We didn't know about these chemicals until pretty recently, and we certainly didn't know about them in Coakley's.
They're called emerging contaminants.
Yeah,
so it's something we're still learning about.
That's right. They're sort of a new scientific concept. And so Coakley's management plan does not cover PFAS chemicals. And so they would need to rewrite it basically to cover that. And that's what neighbors would like to see happen. And neighbors think that in order to manage the PFAS at the site, you're going to need more invasive cleanup, basically. Right now, Coakley is doing what they call monitored natural attenuation, where we basically just leave it alone and let it kind of take care of itself, which is practical for the contaminants they used to think were there, but not for PFAS. PFAS is man-made. It does not biodegrade, and it stays in nature and in your body for a long time. And so the neighbors that the EPA was meeting with this week would like to see a pump and treat system where they would actually pump out the waste, clean it up, and put it back into the ground.
Okay, let me remind our listeners to join us, Annie. Then I have a huge question for you, because I think we're going from the hyper-local to the national with what you just said. The phone number for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns about water contamination in New Hampshire, especially these PFAS chemicals that Annie is telling us about, 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. 892-6477. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Let's get your questions in now for NHPR reporter Annie Ropeek about this class of contaminants known as PFAS and what's been going on with them in New Hampshire. So correct me if I'm wrong, Annie, the original rules and regs around Superfund sites like Coakley don't take into account these emerging contaminants, PFAS. If EPA decides, partly based on its conversations with folks here in the Granite State, that we do need to set some hard and fast federal standards for these, this is a ginormous deal.
Yes.
For the state and for the country, really.
Absolutely. So these are chemicals that are found in household products. They're found in lots of manufactured goods, plastics, nonstick coatings, performance fabrics, cleaners and waxes and firefighting foams. They're designed to make things resist things, so make them water resistant or fire resistant or grease resistant. So imagine anything that has those qualities probably contains one of these PFAS chemicals. That being said, that means that they're in lots of landfills, lots of waste dumps
sure,
all over the country.
Stuff you throw out and then they just leach out.
That's right. And so as they emerge, you know, these are landfill sites that are make up a large portion of Superfund sites in the country that, you know, probably have PFAS in them. And if they were to list PFAS as a Superfund contaminant, basically, which is one thing that EPA is talking about doing this year, that would be a big deal for Coakley. It would basically mean EPA had sort of new grounds on which to look at cleaning up the site in a different way, because now they know there's a contaminant there that they know they're supposed to take care of. Therefore, they could actually make a plan for doing it, as opposed to looking for, you know, an imminent risk to human health and sort of taking a emergency exception action, which is what they'd kind of need to do right now.
By the way, these chemicals, PFAS, PFAS. Didn't we used to call them PFOAs?
Yeah, I used to call them PFCs. I'm really trying to stick with that because it's a lot easier to say than PFAS.
But. Yeah.
So PFOA is one of the class. That's a single type of chemical that's part of the overall like subset of PFAS. PFC stands for perfluorinated chemicals. PFAS stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. So this is the broad umbrella that all of these types of chemicals, it's a certain, you know, process to make them fall under. And PFOA is one of the ones that the government has talked about managing. Obviously, a lot of people would like them to take the whole broad subset into account, but this is thousands of chemicals and, you know, PFAS is just one of thousands more of industrial chemicals that the government, you know, can barely keep up with. And so it's really indicative of a larger problem. And this year they're trying to kind of get their arms around it.
Well, and speaking of the larger problem, these chemicals have showed up elsewhere in New Hampshire with more significance, I think. So just remind us where else they've turned up,
That's
Annie.
Right. So important to note that New Hampshire, not every state has a standard for PFAS, has limits on PFAS, and New Hampshire does. It follows the federal advice, which is that non-binding limit you mentioned, which is 70 parts per trillion, which I like to say is like 70 grains of sand in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. It's just important to get that visual, I think. And that's the limit at which they say these substances will start to threaten your health. They can.
So say that again. 7 grains of sand.
70.
70 in a swimming pool.
In an Olympic-sized swimming pool.
Wow.
Yeah, that's parts per trillion. Parts per billion, I think, is a drop of ink in a bathtub. There's all these little metaphors. But so that means that some studies have linked PFAS to cancer, to other serious health issues. And at 70 parts per trillion, the government is saying you might be at risk. So
that's the state government.
So that's what the state government has adopted. Now, I was talking to the State Department of Environmental Services yesterday, and they said, you know, it seems like we have a lot of these PFAS issues, but that's just because we're looking for them. So we've kind of created the problem by trying to solve it. Other states aren't looking for them, and therefore they have no PFAS problems, right? And so in this state, we've had a few big issues crop up because we've been looking for them. One would be at Pease International Trade Port. There was a big release of PFCs or PFAS discovered there several years ago that threatened children and families and has been the subject of a big federal cleanup effort.
Related to firefighting foam,
yeah,
right, Annie?
So a lot of these chemicals are linked to military installations, and because they are found in firefighting foams and other substances that are used at, say, an Air Force base. And also at your local fire department, but not in such huge quantities. So that was why they were found at Pease. And Peace has become one of the poster children for this issue in a lot of ways. Our two senators have gotten Peace into a bunch of national studies about this. They've really kept it in the conversation. And that was one of sort of the earliest big issues that we saw about this, which I think was in 2014. The other one is in Merrimack, Bedford, Manchester area around the St. Gobain plastics factory. And St. Gobain told the state a couple years ago that they had put a bunch of PFAS into the air through their smokestacks, and that PFAS had settled into the ground and gotten in the water and was turning up in people's wells. So fast forward 2 years, hundreds of families in that area are still drinking bottled water every day.
Wow.
They don't drink their tap water.
2 years.
For 2 years. And
St. Gobain, that's a pain in the neck.
It is. It is. Everyone I talked to just say, we're tired of it. You know, it's surreal. I can't imagine having this happen to me in America. But it's the reality, just like it is in Flint, Michigan, for these families here in New Hampshire. St. Gobain recently agreed to pay to connect those people to public water systems. They've been paying for their bottled water. That was the state's first big sort of issue like this. I mean, it was their biggest groundwater contamination investigation they've ever undertaken, and it's still ongoing.
Let's take a call, Annie. And this is Mindy calling in, and I'm guessing this is State Representative Mindy Mesmer. Go ahead, Mindy.
Thank you very much. Yes, it is State Representative Mindy Mesmer. As you know, Laura, I've been really involved in this issue, and Annie, thank you so much for covering this issue in depth. I wanted to just sort of talk about a couple of things that were mentioned. I would contend that we're not creating a problem in the state of New Hampshire by looking for it. We're assessing the problem caused by polluters. So I want to make certain that, you know, it's not because we're looking for them that we're finding them, but that we're finding a problem that has been created by polluters that we were unaware of for a long time. And a lot of my legislative work that's been going on the state level has been to really try to look at other states and what they're doing with respect to these compounds and what they're determining as safe or not safe. And other states like Vermont and New Jersey and Minnesota now have really come down a lot below that 70 level that you referenced, the EPA advisory number that the Department of Health of Environmental Services has adopted here in New Hampshire. And much of my work has been to say, hey, look at other states, what they're doing. Why are they so much lower? And, you know, I think that is where the concerns from the residents around Coakley Landfill have come in the city of Portsmouth people. And that's because we see other states doing that, coming down much lower because of health concerns. And now, just a few weeks ago, we heard that ATSDR, the Society, the American Substance, I can't remember what it stands for, but it's
Centers for Disease Control, yeah.
Yeah, that has issued, withholding information back since at least January. And I would contend probably they knew about it for a couple of years because it takes them so long to get this thing through the process.
Well, Representative Mesmer, thank you for calling in. And I did want to address a couple of the issues that you raised with Annie anyway. So, Annie, first of all, the point, state by state, there are different standards.
Yeah, so Representative Mesmer is talking about how states like Vermont and New Jersey have much lower standards for PFAS than New Hampshire does. And New Hampshire follows the federal limits. So as the EPA develops these new federal standards, people like Representative Mesmer and neighbors around Coakley would like to see those standards be more along the lines of Vermont and New Jersey. And the study she's referencing that comes from the Centers for Disease Control, this was big news a few weeks ago that reportedly the Environmental Protection Agency asked the Centers for Disease Control or sort of was pressuring them not to release this study because it would have been, I think the quote was, a public relations nightmare, that the study showed that EPA was far overestimating how safe these chemicals were. That Vermont, New Jersey probably have it more correct than New Hampshire does.
That's what CDC said.
If this data is correct.
And EPA said, CDC, please don't release this because it's going to be a headache.
Expecting that to probably come out sometime soon here. And that, too, could seriously affect what's going on at Coakley because, you know, right now we're sort of following these federal state standards that if we find out that they are way too, you know, lenient, that could change things for the people.
So just to super clarify, folks who don't follow this as closely, so right now, some states have no standard. Some states have a standard, like New Hampshire. Vermont's is much lower, as you said. But the federal government right now just has an advisory. It doesn't have a hard standard that every business, town, you know, has to follow.
Right. That's right.
But this is what makes the visit to New Hampshire so interesting is because now they might actually come out with a standard.
That's right. So soon after we got the news about that withheld report, we heard the EPA had decided they were going to start developing a hard limit, an actual regulation that says you know, if you do not keep the level of PFAS in your water under this level, you'll get fined or you'll have to change it. And that would be new. And they would also list it as a Superfund contaminant and take a bunch of other steps that would really make PFAS like lead or like arsenic, you know, something that we regulate, that we check for all over the country. And so New Hampshire has been a big part of this process so far.
Given these three issues that we've talked about,
that's right,
Coakley, Pease, and St. Gobain.
And people, you know, like Senators Shaheen and Hassan have really been pushing to have New Hampshire be, you know, at the fore of this issue, and it's worked out. And so so the very first meeting about developing these standards is going to be in Portsmouth at the end of this month. They're having a meeting in each region of the country. There's 10 EPA regions, and we're region one. So the New England-wide meeting about how to develop federal PFAS standards will be in Portsmouth. Folks from around Coakley will be there. The senators will be there. I'm sure Representative Messmer will be there. And some of these top EPA officials, too, talking about neighbors' concerns and what they'd like to see in these new regulations.
So if the EPA does settle on a level, and if it's a pretty strict level, Annie, what does that mean for, you know, businesses like St. Gobain, towns that have landfills that might have these chemicals coming out? I mean, you said earlier, these chemicals are everywhere, so.
Yeah, it could be a really big deal. I mean, they've set up the St. Gobain plan, for example, you know, assuming a certain limit will be in place. And if that limit gets way lower, they might have to go back to the drawing board and install infrastructure for more homes that, you know, didn't meet the first limit but now meet the new limit. Or the state might expand the area that St. Gobain has to deal with. You know, they're under one certain settlement right now, but that's based on certain assumptions that could change. And the same goes for Coakley, that Coakley is safe under the current standards, but if those standards change, it may no longer be considered safe. And that would
be the drawing board,
EPA's
then.
Trigger to come in and actually do some more invasive cleanup potentially.
Wow, Annie, lots to keep track of. Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Annie Ropeek again. She's NHPR's environment reporter. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. And remember, our conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. Also, check us out on Instagram for some fun behind-the-scenes photos of what we're up to. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.